They were waiting in the stern, each team standing by its own black rubber landing boat. Sean smelt the musky odour in the air and grimaced. He didn't like it, but the use of boom before a contact had become a tradition in the scouts. "It's an old African custom," he consoled himself. "The mad Mahdi's fuzzy-wuzzies smoked it before they revved old Kitchener at Khartoum." "Sergeant Major, the smoking light is out," he grated, and he heard them shuffle in the darkness as they rubbed out their cannabis cigarettes on the deck. Sean realized that the smoke dulled the edge of their fear and bolstered that reckless bravado that was also part of the scout's tradition. But he had never used it. He relished the sensation of fear. It throbbed in his blood and beat in his brain. He was never more alive than at a time like this, going into battle and mortal danger. He would not wish to shade that pure, clean flame of fear. One at a time, the flexible rubber hulls, laden with men and equipment, slid down the stern chute of the trawler and splashed softly onto the water. The boatmen started the Toyota outboards, and they burbled gently in the night. Even on a still and windless night like this, the sound would not carry 100 yards. They formed up into a long black snake, a boat's length between them. Sean was in the leading inflatable with 3 of his best men. The boatman shone a hooded penlight over the stern to keep the boats that followed on station. They moved off quietly towards the land. Sean was standing in the stern. On a lanyard around his neck was a small luminous compass, but he relied mainly on the night scope to bring them into the shore. It was a Zeiss image enhancer. It looked like a large pair of plastic-coated binoculars. Ahead of him, the breaking surf flared green fire in the lens, and he made out clearly the dark spot in the line that marked the river mouth. He touched the boatman's shoulder to redirect him. The next wave lifted and shoved them as it slid by under the hull, and they heard its hoarse susurration on either hand as they ran through the pass into the calmer waters of the lagoon. Through the Zeiss lens he saw the shaggy tops of the palms silhouetted against the cloud banks and the open throat of the river ahead. He flicked the penlight, and Isor Gondele's boat moved up alongside. "There she is," he leant over to whisper to the big Matabele and pointed out the river mouth. "I see it." Isor had his own nightscope held to his eyes. "Tear their guts out!" The pod of 3 attack boats moved off together, and Sean watched them disappear into the river and merged with the loom of the land. He whispered to the boatman, and they turned parallel with the beach. As they ran down the lagoon, Sean scanned the shore through the Zeiss lens. Half a mile from the mouth, he made out in the gloom of the palm grove the square outline of a hut, and then beyond it a second. "It fits with Bella's description," he decided. They ran towards the beach. Now he saw the gleam of metal above the nearest hut. It was the tall Christmas tree antenna and dish of a satellite communications center. "That's it." Sand grated softly beneath the keel of the inflatable, and they leapt over the side into the blood-warm water that reached to their knees. Sean led them ashore. The beach sand was so white that he could see the little ghost crabs scuttling away ahead of them. The men raced to the edge of the palm grove and dropped into cover below the high water ridge. Sean took a few moments to check his bearings. According to Isabella's description on her first visit, the communications center was where they had received and searched her. She told him there were 2 or 3 female radio operators running the center. In addition, she had counted approximately 20 paraguards who were billeted in the barracks beyond the wire. The gate to the compound was always locked at sunset. She had warned him of that. There was always a sentry posted there. He patrolled the wire, and they changed the guard every 4 hours. "Here he comes now," Sean murmured, as he saw the dark shape of the sentry moving along the barbed wire fence. He lowered the nightscope and whispered to the scout who lay beside him. 20 paces ahead, Porky. He's moving left to right. Got him." Porky Suaves was a Portuguese Rhodesian whose speciality was the slingshot. He could hit a dove on the wing at 50 meters. At 10 meters he could drive a steel ball bearing clean through the bone of a man's skull. He slid forward like a night adder, and as the Cuban sentry came level, He rose on one knee and drew like a longbowman. The double surgical rubber strands of the slingshot snapped, and the sentry collapsed without a sound into the fluffy white sand.
"Go!"
said Sean softly, and the second scout ran forward with the heavy wire cutters. The strands of barbed wire made little musical pinging sounds as they parted. Sean ran to the opening. As each of the scouts slipped through the hole in the wire, he slapped their shoulders and pointed them to their targets. He sent two of them to the main gate to take the sentries there, two to shut down the communications center, and the rest of them to hose down the barracks at the rear of the compound and to cull the garrison guards. If the arrangements were the same as last time, the first hut on the right of the radio room should be Isabella's. Nicky would be in the second one with his Cuban nursemaid. Isabella called her Adra. From Sean's estimate of the situation, the nursemaid was one of the uglies. She would have to go. He would cull her at the first opportunity. Sean ran towards the line of huts, but before he reached them, a woman started to scream in the communications hut. The sharp, hysterical bursts of sound raked Sean's nerve endings. The screams were cut off by a short burst of automatic fire. "Here we go," Sean thought. And the night erupted with gunfire and flame, and the mortal thrill of combat. Isabella slept fitfully, and woke a little before midnight to the sound of thunder and of jet engines passing at altitude overhead. She threw aside the mosquito net and ran out into the night. The wind, generated by a mighty thunderstorm that was moving up from the south, flapped the skirts of her nightdress around her bare legs, and rattled the palm fronds. The sound of jet engines rose and fell as wind and cloud blanketed it. It seemed to her that there were more than one aircraft up there above the cloud. She hoped that one of them was the Lear, with her father and Gary aboard. "Have you picked up my signal?" she wondered, as she strained her eyes into the black heavens. "Can you hear me, Daddy? Do you know I'm here?" She saw nothing, not even the shine of a single star. And the sound of the engines overhead faded, and left only the sighing of the wind and the rumble and crash as the thunderstorm fired its opening broadsides. The rain began to fall again, and she ran back into the hut. She dried her hair and her bare feet, and stood at the window looking down towards the beach. "Please, God, let them know we are here. Help Sean to find us." At breakfast, Nicholas said to her, "I haven't had a chance to try out my new soccer ball."
"But we've played with it every day, Nicky."
"Yes, but I mean with good players."
And then, realizing what he had said,
You're a good player for a girl. I think you'd make an excellent goalkeeper with some more practice. But, Mama, I would like some of my friends from school."
"I don't know." Isabella looked at Adra.
"Are your friends allowed here?"
Adra did not look round from the wood stove.
"Ask José," she said. "Perhaps it will be allowed."
That afternoon, José and Nicholas arrived at the compound with a jeep load of small black boys. The soccer match on the beach was noisy and passionately contested. On three occasions, Isabella and José had to untangle a knot of punching and kicking bodies. After each battle, play was resumed as though nothing had happened. Isabella was selected as goalkeeper for the Sons of the Revolution. But after she had let through five goals, Nicholas, the team captain, came to her tactfully.
"I think you're tired, Mama, and would like to rest now."
And she was sent to the sidelines. The Sons of the Revolution beat the Angolan Tigers 26-5, and Isabella felt very guilty about those five. After the final whistle, Isabella produced a 2-kilo bag of toffees and chocolates from her gift box, and her lack of athletic prowess was immediately forgiven by her captain and both teams. At dinner, Nicholas chatted easily, and Isabella tried to act as naturally. But her eyes kept straying to the window of the hut and the beach. If Sean were coming, he would come tonight. She noticed Adra watching her thoughtfully. She made another effort to follow Nicky's conversation, but she was thinking about Adra now.
Could they take her with them, she wondered.
Would she want to come? Adra was such a reticent and secretive person that she could never never even guess at her true feelings except her love for Nicky. That was all that was certain. Could she trust her enough to warn her of the rescue, she wondered? Should she give Adra the choice of coming away or remaining? In fairness, could she take Nicky from her after all these years of devotion to him? Surely it would break her heart. And yet could she trust her enough to tell her? Could she risk their freedom, hers and Nicky's? And could she risk the lives of her brother and all those other gallant young men who were attempting to rescue them? More than once during the meal she was on the point of speaking to Adra, but each time she shied away from it at the last moment. When she tucked Nicky into bed, he lifted his face to her, and she kissed him quite naturally. He held her tightly for a moment.
"Do you have to go away again, Mama?" he asked.
"Would you come with me if you could?" she countered.
"And leave Padre and Adra?"
He lapsed into silence. It was the first time he'd ever spoken to her of Ramon, and it troubled her deeply. Was it respect or fear she had detected in his voice? She could not be certain. On an impulse she began, "Nicky, tonight, if anything happens, don't be afraid." "What will happen?" He sat up with interest.
"I don't know. Probably nothing."
He looked disappointed and dropped back on the pillow.
"Good night, Nicky," she whispered.
Adra was waiting for her in the darkness between the huts. It was the opportunity Isabella had waited for.
"Adra," she whispered, "I have to talk to you. Tonight..."
she broke off.
"Tonight,"
Adra prompted her. And when she still hesitated, Adra went on,
"Yes, tonight he will come. He says to expect him. He could not come before, but tonight he will come to you."
Isabella felt panic rise to wash reason away.
"Oh, God, are you sure?" Then she caught herself. "That's wonderful. I've waited so long."
All thoughts of warning Adra of the rescue attempt were wiped from her mind. How could she face Ramon, now that she realized what a cruel and evil monster he truly was? How could she let him touch her without trembling?
"I must go now,"
Adra whispered, and slipped away into the darkness, leaving her alone with her terror. She had planned to wear jeans and jersey beneath her nightdress, ready to leave when Sean came, but she dared not do that now. She lay so long alone in the darkness beneath the mosquito net that at last she began to hope that Sean would come to her before Ramon did, or at least that dawn would save her. Then suddenly she knew that he was in the hut with her. She smelt him before she heard him. The faint but distinctive odour of his body that had always aroused her so readily. Her nostrils and every nerve in her body jumped tight. Her breathing seized up in her throat. She heard the whisper of his feet across the floor of the hut, and then his touch upon the bed.
"Ramon!"
Her breath escaped on an explosive gust.
"Yes, it is me."
His voice struck her like a blow in the face. She felt him lift the mosquito net, and she lay rigid. His fingertips brushed her face, and she thought she might scream aloud. She did not know how to act, what to say to him. "He will know." She realized that she was panicking. She dare not move or speak.
"Bella," he said.
And she heard the first suspicion in his tone. In sudden inspiration, she reached up and seized him.
"Don't talk," she whispered fiercely. "I cannot wait another moment. Don't say anything. Take me now, Ramon."